Welcome to The Growth Machine, your backstage pass to the minds behind today's most successful digital marketing agencies. Each episode, we unpack real-world playbooks for scaling revenue, delighting clients, and building cultures that last. The Growth Machine is powered by Dream Giant, the partner that sparks qualified interest, turns leads into signed contracts, and nurtures a loyal tribe of eager buyers. Ready to think bigger? Hit play and let's dream giant. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Growth Machine. I'm your host, Shane Miller, and today I have Patrick Cumming, the Director of Marketing at Client Boost, one of the biggest performance marketing agencies in the world. How you doing, Patrick?
I'm good, man. Thank you for having me on the show. Excited for the combo.
Yeah, absolutely. Really excited to have you on just because of the sheer amount of like recognition that Client Boost has across the space. I'm not going to lie, when I saw you come through, I was like, really, really, the whole team was really, really stoked.
I love it, man. I kind of have this story of, I joined Client Boost about 2 years ago. And the day I announced it to LinkedIn, I'd probably been posting on LinkedIn consistently for about 6 months or something. So I didn't have a huge following, but it started growing. And so a ton of people that were following me actually reached out and were like, hey, man, congrats on the Client Boost role. You know, a few of them said that Client Boost content in the past was responsible for kind of helping them, you know, educate themselves, because we'd put a ton of investment historically into kind of that old school top of funnel how to blog content. So that was super, super cool for me and kind of super surreal, because I was also a consumer of that content. So it was a little dream come true in some ways.
Nice. So you were pretty aware of Client Boost before you actually came on the scene.
Yeah. I think a lot of people in paid ads, especially Google ads, I would say historically Client Boost reputation is heavily on the Google ads side of things. You know, a lot of the key kind of concepts that lots of PPC marketers kind of use day to day still were developed in the early days of Client Boost, which is, again, just kind of super cool to be a part of, like, reputationally as well.
Awesome. And so you say that, like, especially Google ads, stuff like that, people might know who you guys are. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I can, actually. So it's funny. I was working on some content topics for LinkedIn for our CEO today. And so it's interesting because one of the, you know, the highest performing posts from him historically was actually talking about his journey. And so his journey was he was living in Denmark, moved over to the US, which is where his dad was. And he'd moved over to the US with the plan of becoming a marine biologist, quickly got bored of that and found that he could make money just running Google ads for companies. And so he, you know, quickly leveled up at that. And I think in his words, he said, became dangerous at Google ads. And it kind of started from there. So I think initially he turned Client Boost into a different agency and then sort of moved out of that initial agency that they started out and then into Client Boost. So I think this for me also is, you know, talking about differentiators of agencies, in my experience at least, there's not too many agencies where the main founder is actually somebody that's really clued in on how to use the platforms. But with Jonathan, I mean, he still jumps on sales calls and will get people to open up their Google Ads accounts and show them where they're going wrong, which is pretty cool.
Yep. I mean, it's really interesting. You're not the first person to kind of tell me that, you know, one of the leading partners came from a science background, right? I actually had a new client we're bringing on. Oh, you know what? They were actually a guest on the podcast, Emma Davis with The Working Planet. Their founders came over and were biologists or they were chemistry, either in chemistry, something like that. I feel bad now. I'm forgetting what it was, but I know that they were working on fueling jets in midair. Right. Like that was wow. What they were doing before they started their agency. And so I think a lot of people do come from that science background because data analytics is so, you know, specific and, I mean, analytical that when they have that science mind, it really transfers well.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think there's a reason it's called performance marketing as well, right? Which is, for us, we're very experimentation focused. So we have an internal system called Boost Flow, which is kind of our own take on a kind of like test and learn framework. But at its very core, the idea is analyze the data, form a hypothesis, run the experiment, analyze the results, and then run an autopsy. So like, were you successful? Were you unsuccessful? If you were successful, is there any way you can scale it? Can we do it even better? If it was unsuccessful, why was it unsuccessful? Was it unsuccessful because the tactic didn't work? Or was it unsuccessful because the execution was off? Was it unsuccessful because of market conditions or something like that? And so I can see why it attracts those scientific minds, because I think that's there's two parts to it. That's in a really effective way to run marketing. I think there's a place for vibe marketing too, and some people do that really, really well. But when you're really listening to the data and acting on data, that's also really powerful. And I think in terms of, for Client Boost being one of the biggest agencies, having scaled up to like 20 million ARR, for example, in terms of value propositions that not many agencies are able to offer, it is that data-driven approach. And we can, when you have an internal framework to actually do it, it's much more compelling and believable when you're in a sales conversation.
Yeah, completely makes sense to me. And so explain to me, what kind of client comes to Client Boost and finds the most success? Like, who do you guys actually absolutely knock it out of the park for?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. And I think if I'm being fully transparent here, because I think it's better to have these conversations in a fully transparent way anyways, that's something that we're always, always trying to dial in. So I wouldn't even say we've fully figured it out yet. When I'm kind of analyzing the data, so I did this this exercise at the beginning of the year when I'm trying to think about, okay, strategically, where are we going to place our bets this year? Who are we going to focus on? It was kind of interesting because it wasn't necessarily anything to do with industry annual revenue, industry or annual revenue or company size that was kind of the defining factor of who's best for us. It's really more to do with the size of the team that we're working with, and specifically the size of the marketing team. So if there's a much, much bigger marketing team, we can still make it work. But it's just a little bit harder because there's usually so many chains of command to go through that it'll take, 60 days to get an experiment signed off. So we just can't execute fast enough to learn fast enough to fuel the engine and grease the wheel. So I typically say smaller marketing teams where they're really looking for an agency to be that extension of the team in some way, but also how well they've kind of got the foundations laid before they come to us. And what I mean by that is, do they know what category they're operating in? Do they really understand what the, competitive atmosphere and market conditions are like? Have they dialed in who they're talking to and what the messaging is? Because for us, we have, we have skilled growth managers that can support with that conversation. But if it's not something that's a priority at the company, you can almost guarantee that we're going to be less successful for the client, because like the first 3 to 6 months is just going to be figuring out which messaging lands and which messaging doesn't. And that means it's just much harder for us to get the kind of ROI to keep clients on. But again, that's just a problem that we're trying to figure out, because that's also another potential revenue stream for us, but we just have to frame it in a different way and figure out the best way to solve that problem too.
Gotcha. Makes sense. And so what happens if the team has no marketing person? So is that like the golden goose for you guys, or is that a red flag?
Is that the golden goose or a red flag? That's a really good question. It's really difficult to answer. I feel like such a marketer when I say it depends, but it kind of does. It depends on the person. We have a lot of clients where that that is the case, and a lot of long-term clients where that is the case. Again, it works best when it's, you know, somebody that maybe wants to be a little more hands-on off. So if they want to be hands-on on the marketing every, you know, every single day, while they're also, you know, we're having a conversation earlier about founders wearing so many hats. You know, if the founder's wearing lots and lots of hats, but and can't dedicate the time to, you know, reviewing things that we're sending across, getting us what we need to run the experiments, then that's when it cannot work. But, you know, if after 3 months they're, you know, confident in the work that we're delivering and they're happy to say, cool, you've got the green light to move quickly, then that's when it can really, really work well and be more of the golden goose, so to speak.
Got it. Got it. I love it. And so kind of tell me what the growth strategy is, man. So what are you guys doing right now to bring these clients on?
Yeah. Good question. So there are multiple components to the growth strategy. Cause I think one thing that we made, I don't know if we necessarily made a mistake on this historically, cause we do have a pretty well-known brand, but we never like really, really invested heavily into brand marketing in the past. We had strongly relied on SEO was really the predominant channel, and then paid ads platforms as well. And so when I took over, I was very, very adamant that we still needed to have a big focus on those channels. And for the very reason that if we're going to sell something to somebody, we one, like better believe in it as a strategy. And I know lots of agencies don't do that. They, you know, they sell Google ads and they sell LinkedIn ads, but they don't run it for themselves. For me, if you wouldn't put your own money into it, then like that's a red flag, and it's going to be a harder sell to customers, you know. A big part of our growth strategy is that I am constantly running experiments on our own marketing channel and then just writing about the results of it on LinkedIn. And the goal of that is to, you know, say to clients, we want to test what works and what doesn't with our own money first before asking you to, you know, potentially take a chance on strategies that may or may not work. And so that kind of leads me onto the other part of the strategy, which is we call it eating our own dog food, I guess. And so that's something that's very, very content focused. And that's things like me being on this podcast right now is a huge part of that strategy. I've also built out our own podcast called The Client Boost Kitchen, which I've called the vehicle for all the other content that we do. Especially for the kind of priority client for us right now is B2B and B2B SaaS. Although we are actively we do have an e-commerce arm as well. So we're actively building that out. And so the idea behind the Client Boost Kitchen is that I run these experiments and then record either a solo podcast about it or bring guests on to talk about it. And it's actionable steps that, you know, prospects can take away and apply to their own marketing based on, you know, what's actually working right now and not based on these kind of dated playbooks from, you know, 2016 that, you know, I love HubSpot, but a lot of people are still going there for playbooks that just no longer work, right? And so that's another huge part. And then we'll take what lands and what, well, I guess it's more of like a kind of like feedback loop, but we'll take what lands and what doesn't land from that podcast and then repurpose that into multiple different areas. So it's very, very content, very, very content led.
Yeah. I mean, I think people underestimate the power of content, right? Because I read a study and it said that in the B2B high ticket space, a prospect needs to spend about 7 hours with you before they make a purchasing decision. And so whether that's like this on the phone or on a pitch call or watching your content, you know, they need to spend on average about 7 hours. Now, there are, you know, great salespeople I can do it in less, but like that is usually the average. And that's why people who are selling retainers in like the $10,000 a month, you know, range are having like 8 calls because they're meeting with different teams and this and that. So like, I think the content is brilliant because it helps, you know, burn through those hours.
Yeah. 100%. And I think the main thing to focus on as well, and this is something that we've been trying to find the balance on this year, is the balance between volume and quality. of execution on the content side. So I think that there's a real risk. And I think we maybe fell into this trap a little bit in kind of June. We were, you know, experimenting with some new ways of using AI, for example, to try and scale output. And so there's a real risk that companies will think, oh, if I just increase volume of content, that will lead to increased touch points, which will then lead to you know, increased sales or whatever. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. So I think there's two ways to look at it. One way is like, yes, 7 hours. I would also look at it through a time frame. So it's not that if you compress those 7 hours, you'll get them faster. It's more to do with the fact that the way markets work is that in any given quarter, about 5% of the market is in market, about 5% of the market is out market. And so what that means is that actually, I think it takes around 320 days to close a customer from first ad impression to closed. And so the best way to kind of increase your odds of being the person they, you know, want to work with when they do move in market is content, but it has to be quality. And so if you try and skip straight to content volume by scaling AI slop, as it's come to be known, it won't work. And the truth is, like, creating good quality content is hard and it takes time, and it's difficult to know what good and good isn't, because it seems to be changing so often. And so actually a big part of what I'm focusing on at the moment isn't just creating content, but trying to work out, like, what's a set of guidelines that we can follow so that every piece of content hits, you know, the minimum criteria to be good enough to get us remembered, to make people want to work with us, and to make people understand why we're different than anybody else and why they should choose us. And that's a real challenge. It's not easy.
Yeah, I completely get it. And so what would you say is, like, the biggest challenge you're facing during all of this? Like, I mean, you have so many growth engines, right? So what is the biggest challenge that you're facing in your growth journey?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's multiple parts to it. Probably the biggest one is, and this is based on a mistake that I made a few months back. So I was, you know, essentially a team of one until about June. I did have a content writer supporting me, but it was only 50% of her time working on the marketing stuff. And so when we hired the new people, my logic was, if I just hire really talented people and get out of their way, so I'm not going to tell them what to do, I'm not going to set clear output expectations, that the output will take care of itself. We'll just be producing, you know, great quality content at a rate of knots. And what ended up actually happening was we were all working on like 1,000 different ideas and produced nothing for about 6 weeks. And that's an exaggeration. I won't say we produced nothing, but nothing new or meaningful that really, you know, was an evolution or improvement on what we were already doing for about 6 weeks. And so the reason that happened was because we actually didn't set any goals and we didn't set any clear expectations around outputs. And so as soon as we put that in place and said, okay, here's the core KPIs for the people on the team. Here's what, based on what's working right now, when I reverse engineer what I think needs to be true in order to hit these KPIs, here's the minimum content volume, the minimum output that we've got to achieve. And already after implementing that process, we're seeing like just a way higher output of quality content, already kind of anecdotally seeing like a decent lift in inbound in October, for example, versus September, and already early signs of strong inbound in November. And so I would say that's probably the biggest part. And then the other one is, and this is always tricky, but how do you keep content progressing without becoming a bottleneck yourself? And I imagine this will be a real problem for some agencies, founders, because it's their brand, it's their baby, and they want to have it, you know, a touch on every single thing that comes out. But ultimately that's, you know, potentially just going to be a bottleneck, which actually hurts growth. And so that's another tricky thing. And so, you know, coming back to one of the biggest things I'm working on right now is how do we set the kind of like minimum criteria for what good is. We call it world class internally. So what does world class look like? That's going to be really, really important so that you can kind of create that standard, empower your team with it, and then kind of step back and get out of their way and just let them cook.
Got it. Got it. And my kind of last question for you is, you know, what does bad content look like? Like when people are starting to create their content strategy, what should they avoid?
Yeah, this is a really easy one for me. So bad content for me is when companies focus on writing what they want to write versus writing what the audience wants to hear. So if you sit down to write a piece of content, you're like, today I want to write about X. It's already going to be a bad piece of content in my mind. It may be beautifully well written. It may have the nicest, most aesthetic graphics on it, but ultimately it's not going to land. And if it does land, I imagine it's not going to drive the kind of meaningful results that you would actually be looking for. And so, in terms of how that turns up in content, a lot of the times it will be a lot of, you know, this is very old school advice, but, you know, a lot of sentences that start with we instead of you, for example, it probably won't talk to any customer pain points. It'll more talk about the aspiration, of whatever your business might be trying to achieve, for example, as opposed to talking about the exact pain or the exact situation that your prospect is in right now that you're trying to help them find a path out of, or can help them find a path out of. And so one exercise I would say that I have found really powerful for pulling yourself out of that, because it's really hard to get out of that, like really hard, even when you're aware of it, it's hard not to do that, because it just is fun writing about whatever you want to write about that day. And so what I did is created something called a messaging Bible and just listed out all the different pain points that our customers have based on an analysis of, we interviewed like 180 plus marketing leaders. I analyzed all the sales calls of closed won customers specifically from last year, just the first sales call, to find out what's the reason you're here. Like, why did you reach out to us? What's the pain? Mapped that out by business type. So for us, that's classic lead gen, B2B SaaS or e-commerce. And then for each of those, mapped out what's our POV on this. So what's our point of view on this problem that you have? How do we solve this problem? And then what aspects of our service, or what models and internal frameworks and proprietary software or proprietary frameworks, etc., do we have that solve this problem? And then it's really, really easy to ideate content that actually generates leads, because you can just go to this message map and you can just pick one on any day of the week and just write a post around it. And it's already probably going to be about 80% there, because it's tackling something that's really, really meaningful to the audience.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's such a succinct answer. I think that's so important. Write for your audience, not for you. In past life, I was a screenwriter, and that was one of the biggest pieces of advice is that they told you, if you actually wanted to sell something, was to write for the market. So completely get that. Well, Patrick, thank you so much for joining. For anybody who's listening, if you don't already know who Client Boost is, you're gonna be able to find their information in the podcast description. Again, Patrick, thank you so much for joining.
No problem. It was a pleasure.